Well, there's Warwick Alder's trumpet, and we've been listening to Bernie McGann's Spirit Song. Bernie McGann, as I said, died this week. At the end of last year, just before Christmas, he came in to the Music Show studio, and we had a really nice conversation with him. Maybe we should begin by winding back to the 1950s, and because I wasn't around then, and maybe you could describe the jazz scene in Sydney, you know, El Rocco and all the rest of it. It was a healthy scene. It was a thriving scene.
Yeah, it was. There was quite a community of us younger fellas at the time that were very studious about what we listened to. Mainly records from overseas, and we had a constant flow of them, actually, and late night listening sessions most nights of the week. And there was also the El Rocco, which featured some of the musicians of the time. Frank Smith used to play there. I had a few lessons with Frank, Don Burrows, Judy Bailey, John Sangster, Lynn Christie. Actually worked with Lynn and John Sangster with Stuart Spear playing the drums. So that was a good time. Yeah, it was, but there weren't many other venues. There were jazz clubs around the city, actually, that me and my buddies used to attend on a Sunday, and they kept moving quite regularly to different places. And we'd go out of a Sunday, and we'd get the paper train home in the evening. And
yeah.
It was, see people like Terry Wilkerson was usually the piano player, Ron Gowans. And there were also suburban jazz concerts. I used to go with my father to maybe Parramatta Town Hall and see the traditional boys, Ken Flannery and people like that.
Was it through your father that you got the love of jazz in the first place?
Exactly. I got to thank him for that, yes, because the music was always around the house.
Yeah. Because, I mean, you know, in the 1950s, a young man like you might have just as easily been rock and roll.
Yeah. Well, rhythm and blues, I wouldn't have minded, you know, because that's solid. But I grew up listening to people like Fats Waller was very big at our place, which was fantastic. I love him. I still love him. Mm. Louis Armstrong, Duke Ellington, lots of Benny Goodman records, trios and sextets and all the rest of them. Artie Shaw, Mary Lou Williams, whole gamut of things.
So that's a fairly solid education.
Oh, it was fantastic. And he would have sessions there of a weekend with his buddies. They'd come around and play in the lounge room. Some of his friends were players that played at the Prince Edward when they had bands and theatres.
So this is out of Granville?
Yeah, I was born in Cogra, but we moved to Granville when I was maybe two or something like that. So I grew up on Parramatta Road, Granville, yeah. So yes. I'm a Westie.
Yes. And not a lot of venues out there, I'm assuming.
Well, apart from the Paradance circuit, which lots of big bands playing for dancers in those days.
Yes.
It used to be everywhere. It was one at Lithium, one at Parramatta, various places, just like the old movie theatres that have all gone now, you know. It's just a different time.
When did you pick up a saxophone?
When I was 18, actually. So I was a late starter. I learned the piano from a young age. Then switched to drums. My father was a drummer, so I did deputise for him and did some work. And then from going to these Sunday afternoon sessions in the clubs, I just happened to notice the alto saxophone. They look really nice and compact and shiny, and I thought, I'd heard Paul Desmond in the meantime, because, I mean, the Brubeck phenomenon, you know, I mean, that was very popular, even in black America. Archie Shepp say that's the only jazz he had access to, was the Brubeck Quartet.
Yes.
And it's quite amazing.
And as you say, very popular.
Oh, yeah.
It was almost one of the last times that jazz was very popular.
Well, completely. That's, they made the cover of Time magazine. That's pretty big.
Yes.
And, you know, I guess they made a lot of money, those boys, over the years.
Well, absolutely. Well, let's talk about Paul Desmond, because he's the name that comes up as your early influence.
And he was, yeah.
I must say, I find that slightly puzzling, because He's such a pretty player.
Yeah. And, I think I can be a pretty player too.
But you know what I mean? I mean, you don't sound anything like Paul Desmond, it seems to me. Certainly not the tone of your
instrument. No, I guess not. I guess not.
So, what did you learn from Paul Desmond?
What I learned, I guess, I'm going to say taste, you know, whichever way I want to look at it. I remember when he was a big influence, and I'd play and I'd thought, that's not coming out like Paul Desmond. You know, it's coming out like me, so I better work on me. That was about it, you know. But I still admire him greatly.
When you say taste, do you mean not playing too many notes?
Yeah, and being selective in what you play when you play, yeah. And that's a constant thing, you know, that never goes away.
I think a lot of the other players that you admire, sax players you admire, are actually tenor players.
Yeah, I do.
Dexter Gordon is an obvious name.
I love Dexter Gordon. I just heard him the other night on the ABC digital channel, and that was just wonderful, you know, just like a breath of fresh air. Dexter with a real good band. He's usually with good musicians, I know, but I think it might have been Barry Harris on the piano. I picked up a few notes there, and he's one of my favourites also.
Yes.
And it's not just piano players. Saxophone players. It's musicians right across the board. Drummers, I love them especially, and trumpet players and piano players, bass players, the whole lot.
And do you find you get different things from different players, that you can, as a sax player, that you can pick up something from a drummer?
Yeah, you can certainly pick up something from a drummer when you're playing with a real good drummer, because I tend to work off drummers, you know. I love them, particularly good drummers.
The last time we spoke, I'm pretty sure we were talking about Ugly Beauty, which was an album with just drums and bass.
That's right.
And no harmony instruments in the middle. So right. So that would be a case in point where you're working off, well, John Poche.
Yeah, that's right.
Let's talk about John Poche.
Okay.
Because he's been a constant, really, in your career.
That's
hasn't
right,
he?
Yeah.
When did you first meet him?
First met him at the Macambo in King Street, Newtown. The place is still there. It's a Japanese restaurant, but the neon sign saying Macambo is still there. It's not lit up anymore, but it is still there. The space is still there, you know. So that's where I first met John and Dave Levy. I knew there were sessions going on there, so I walked in one night or whatever and played a few Desmond licks and impressed everybody.
And was there a sort of musical click immediately?
There certainly was with John and Levy. We used to work gigs all over the place, weddings, whatever it might be. We did quite a lot of work in the Avoca Surf Club, which was pretty mad, actually. Those surfies were tough boys, you know. But it was some sort of regular work over the holiday season. So that was good fun, you know.
Yeah, I can't imagine surfies listening to...
No, they didn't particularly listen. All they did was drink.
They didn't listen then either.
But they figured they needed a band.
Right.
We were the guys, and it was okay with us.
Do you know what the points of connection were with John Poche, musically speaking?
Well, we both had a love for the music, for a start.
Mm.
Got a great swagger about his playing.
Yes, he has, and he was something of a pioneer, really, wasn't
yeah.
he?
Yeah, yeah.
In Australian jazz.
That's right, and he's led a couple of very important bands over the years. The Last Straw, it's a very good band.
Yes.
Made one record. It's a really good record, though. And 10-Part Invention, which is a wonderful group.
Yes, you know, and that was his creation, really.
Yeah, that's right. That's his baby.
Yes.
That's right.
You're listening to The Music Show on RN. My guest is Bernie McGann, who we've been wanting to talk to for a while on the show, but 75 years.
Yes.
That seems like a good opportunity to have a sort of retrospective conversation. The kind of jazz that you played, I mean, you talked about listening to trad jazz and listening to Benny Goodman and listening to Fats Waller and Louis Armstrong. What about bop, which is really the basis for what you do?
Well, that came about because of the radio set we had in the old days, huge radio sets. I could pick up the Voice of America, Willis Conover from Washington, D.C., but I think it was a two-hour program most nights of the week. That's when I heard the other guys, Miles Davis and Sonny Rollins, Horace Silver, Art Blakey.
And you went in that direction simply because the music seduced you?
I just liked the passion that was in the playing and the momentum they had and the swing they generated. That sort of impressed me, you know, and the great sounds they put out there. So, you know, it was a pleasure listening to that program. It finally disappeared off the dial for some reason. I'm not sure what it was, but it was a great learning experience to listen to that. And he was a very good programmer too. He's terrific.
And your own sound, again, you mentioned that, you know, you discovered that you didn't sound like Paul Desmond, that you could learn things from Paul Desmond, yeah. but that you had a different sound. Yeah. So how did you set about developing it? And how did you realize when you'd sort of got it?
It took a lot of work for me. A lot of time, probably living in Bundina was a really good thing for me, actually, because I had this big studio in the backyard, National Park, you know. So, and it's a constant problem with musicians, annoying the neighbors or annoying yourself sometimes. People complain. So, and that was the reason I actually left home in the first place. The woman next door was hysterical one day saying, "This music you have must stop." And I thought, well, I think it's time to move, Mum.
There's nothing quite like a saxophone for getting through a wall, is there?
Yes, right. And it'll be 100 degrees, so I'll be in there with the doors locked and the windows down, the blinds drawn, you know, trying to do my best to keep everything cool. But it didn't work. So once I moved to Bundina, I had the National Park as my backyard. Yeah.
So you're just annoying the parrots.
Yes, and it took me a time to be accustomed to it because I'd go out there and play a couple of notes and think, oh, I can't handle this, and jump in the car and go back home.
Right.
But I stuck at it. Once I became accustomed to al fresco, it was fantastic. And I think that probably had a reason for my sound being the way it is, I think.
Which is playing outdoors.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah, no restrictions. You know, it's not like playing in the bathroom, you know, so you've really got to find a core and enlarge that.
Yeah.
You
know, yeah. Like Sonny Rollins playing on the bridge.
Playing on the bridge.
With the traffic.
That's right. That's right. Not bugging anybody at all up there.
Paul Grabowski has suggested that there is something of the cockatoo in your sound. Now, I'm wondering whether, is that...
Well, it's
Bundina kind of suggests that maybe you were continuing to have lessons from the...
Well, it wasn't a conscious thing. It's a possibility, you know. A dry, crackling sort of sound.
Yes. And you were a postman.
Yeah. Well, I was a postman. I was a purist, you know.
Yeah.
I wasn't going to play in the Lees clubs. I tried that a couple of times and it was just an embarrassment. I thought, this is not my forte. I shouldn't be here. So I had a family to support. So I eventually started to work as a postman.
So you preferred to work as a postman rather than playing a kind of music that
I actually did, yeah. And it was physical work, and those guys are very humorous, you know. There's lots of laughing because you're up at 5:30 in the morning sorting mail.
I know, but isn't that not really the best thing for a jazz musician to be up at 5:30 in the morning?
But I wasn't getting to bed at 3. There were a few occasions when I didn't have much sleep for the next day at work. But generally speaking, there weren't many gigs around at all.
Right.
That was before the last straw was formed. So this was like about 1970. Yeah. So I did that for about 8, 9 years.
And then you'd come home and play to the birds.
Yeah, so I'd go home and jump in the car, drive out and just find a spot somewhere and practice. Yeah.
Thank you.
And that's the saxophone of Bernie McGann, and he was playing a tune composed for him by Tony Gorman called The Last Postman, and we heard the bass of Lloyd Swanton and drums of John Poche. You're listening to The Music Show on RN, on Radio Australia and online, and we're remembering Bernie McGann, the great Australian jazz sax player who died this week, someone who knew him well and who worked with him a lot. Particularly recently, is in our Perth studio, and that's Paul Grabowski. Paul, welcome to the show.
Good morning, Andy.
When were you first aware of Bernie's playing?
When I was living in Europe in the early 80s, I met Dale Barlow, who's another eminent Australian saxophone player, and Dale told me a lot about Bernie. We were both in our early 20s. And, I mean, Dale had already had a very illustrious career by that stage, having recorded with Cedar Walton and some great New York jazz musicians. So he was already very much establishing his own voice, and I was very impressed with Dale. And Dale talked all the time about Bernie. I think Dale really regarded Bernie as being one of the biggest influences on him. So when I got back to Australia, one project that I was keen to get going was something that I'd sort of done in Europe a bit, which is bringing together a bunch of different saxophone players and do a kind of really old school, what we would call a carving session, I suppose, a setup where guys can really get a chance to show what they do in comparison to each other. It's a very sort of sporting kind of jazz, really. So we had three alto players. It was Ian Chaplin, who's a Melbourne player, Bob Birtles, and Bernie McGann. And that was the first time I played with Bernie. And that's when I fell in love with his playing and his music. And he's, you know, as you just heard in that interview, he was an extraordinarily interesting man and a wonderful man, full of integrity.
Full of integrity, not actually full of words. He wasn't an easy person to interview. He was rather shy and a bit tongue-tied. Unlike you,
much to my detriment.
I wonder whether you felt working with Bernie that, you know, he did most of his communicating with you through his saxophone.
Well, there are certain people who are much more comfortable expressing themselves through music and through words. You need but think of someone like Archie Roach also, who's a taciturn man but a giant of the music. Look, Bernie could really get going depending on circumstances. He was happy to talk about many things, including politics and sport and many. He had a very wide-ranging and intellectual curiosity.
Yeah, and maybe if I'd asked him about the Rabbitohs.
no doubt, you would have got a very impassioned response.
I think so.
Yeah, at length.
You've written, and indeed we mentioned you in that interview, about Bernie as a very Australian player. Perhaps you could say a little more about that.
Well, yeah, look, I've been thinking about, you know, what I meant when I said those things. Jazz is very much a music of the individual. We all know that there's a language that jazz musicians speak musically, and there's a great deal of commonality in a lot of the notes they choose to play and the way they put notes together, and there is an importance about sound and time and, you know, the ability to be able to create things on top of a rhythm section and the way that jazz musicians interact. So these are all important things. But what sets aside a real master in jazz from the pack is their ability to distill all of that information into something which is completely unique. And there are not many jazz musicians like that, anywhere, really. And for Bernie to have been able to come up with a particular combination of things that he did, in my mind, really does set him quite singularly apart from every other Australian jazz musician. There is no one who sounds like Bernie McGann anywhere. And there is, as he himself identified, something of the dry crackle in his sound. And I'm sure that all that al fresco playing that he talked about in the interview played an enormous role in shaping that sound. You can almost see the sunlight filtering through leaves of trees in the way he plays. And in that last piece, you played The Last Postman, you know, you can hear in that piece the sort of Paul Desmond-ish thing coming through, or indeed the Lee Konitz thing coming through, a sort of cool. So he was able to take the forward thrust of the East Coast jazz musicians, like Sonny Rollins, who he particularly loved, I must say. He was a fanatical Sonny Rollins adherent. And there's a lot about what he plays which is very, very under the spell of Sonny. But he combined it with that Californian kind of slight detachment, and he could really do that very well too. And the wonderful thing about Bernie was he loved all of those guys. He didn't have a kind of partisan view about jazz. He was able to see it as one continuum. And I think, again, that is an Australian ability to be able to stand outside and have, well, I guess you could even describe it as a slightly ironic kind of perspective on the whole music.
Yes. And perhaps it was also because he was, as a player, so much his own man that he didn't feel threatened by anybody else's view of jazz, that he was happy to embrace the ball.
Well, that's exactly right. And I think that that point that he made about not wanting to get caught up in the kind of general grind of a working musician's stuff and having to play a whole lot of music that you really would rather not play and devote your time to mastering your art. I mean, Bernie McGann was an artist, and I think this is the thing that we need first and foremost to understand about him. And I've said before, if jazz were a more mainstream kind of occupation, then the name Bernie McGann would be a canonical name in the minds of most Australians. He is one of our greatest artists.
Yes. And also, you know, it's so recently that I realised what a good composer he was. And it was actually at the beginning of this month at the benefit for him at Bennett's Lane in Melbourne. And hearing his tunes played by other people, played by Phil Noy and Julian Wilson and so forth, without Bernie's sound, and hearing how well they stood up and how beautiful they were.
Oh, well, you know, you played a bit of Spirit Song before. That is surely an Australian jazz classic. Mm. That is a really magnificent kind of quintessential jazz tune. And again, has a sort of West Coast kind of construction about it, really.
What do you mean?
Well, it reminds me a little bit of a sort of Jerry Mulligan kind of composition. It's got a beautiful use of, you know, cyclical harmonic movement, voice leading. It's kind of classical in its construction. And I'm sure influenced by those early Jerry Mulligan, Paul Desmond quartet records. Mm. I mean, they are absolute classics of the West Coast sound. And I can hear an echo of that in that particular piece.
You played mostly standards. With Bernie Paul.
Yeah.
His choice of standards was fairly singular too, really, wasn't it?
Oh, yeah, no. Well, the thing was, the guy was an encyclopedia of tunes. He knew all the tunes, you know. And the particular loves that he had at the time that I worked with him were the music of Thelonious Monk and Duke Ellington. So we did quite a bit of material from those guys. But in the book was a Paul Desmond tune as well. And you know, various show tunes that he would love to play, like Strike Up the Band was one that we used to love to play. Every gig we did Take the Coltrane by Duke Ellington. And I mean, look, just things that, you know, were absolute cracking vehicles for the way that he liked to play. And the other thing about Bernie was you could really stretch out with Bernie. I mean, he would play long solos, you know, beautifully constructed, his mind sort of, you know, working through a series of ideas in a very orderly kind of fashion, and generously allowing the band to have a similar kind of opportunity to really express what jazz is about, which is celebrating the moment.
Indeed. Well, let's celebrate Bernie McGann a little bit more, and we'll hear him playing from last year, actually, with you, Paul, at the Sound Lounge, Jonathan Swartz on bass, Tim Firth on drums, and it's a Duke Ellington tune. In fact, what am I here for? Thank you very much, Paul, for talking to me on today's music show.
Oh, a real pleasure, Andy. Thank you for having me on. Thank you.